The following presentation is brought to you by The Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to longtime Rolling Stone magazine writer and contributing editor Anthony DeCurtis, author of, In Other Words, Artists Talk About Life and Work, as well as Rocking My Life Away, Writing About Music and Other Matters. Stick around. I'm hoping Anthony can help me with an unresolved subscription issue from 1991. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you by Amazon.com, Audible.com, and 1-800-DIAL-DJs. Please stop by the website, MrMedia.com, click on our advertisers, support the show. And remember, there's more than 1,000 interviews available at MrMedia.com. We've been doing this since February 2007. Hope you'll find something you like. And thanks for listening. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience that needs rock and roll every day in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. I cannot tell a lie, or at least not too many. I let my Rolling Stone magazine subscription end around the same time my Playboy magazine subscription did about a decade ago. My hearing took a beating over the years, probably not helped by my own stint as a rock music critic in the 1980s, and standing too close to one too many heavy metal hair bands in concert, and live shows kind of lost their appeal for me. And of course, you get passed by a generation of music if that happens. And that's what happened to my interest in Rolling Stone magazine. Now, as for Playboy, well, just how many articles can you really read before succumbing to the photos? And once you've seen two in every size, shape, race, and ethnicity, well, or you know what, at this age, maybe it's just low T. I don't really know. But we'll save that for the next special episode of Mr. Media. The one characteristic, however, of both magazines that I enjoyed for decades was the writing. And if you read Rolling Stone over the last 30 years or so, you can't help but know the work of my guest today, writer and contributing editor Anthony DeCurtis. His writing was always crisp, his questions always the ones that you wanted answered, and his ubiquity across a range of topics from issue to issue only reinforced his smarts. Now, DeCurtis is still connected to the magazine today, but he's broadened his scope in recent years. Last year, for example, he co-authored The Soundtrack of My Life, the memoir of record label legend Clive Davis. This year, he's working on a biography of the late Lou Reed, and he won a Grammy Award for his liner notes on Eric Clapton's Crossroads box set. And, I know, it's a lot of conjunctions, and he wrote an introduction for an upcoming book of Clapton photos called Journeyman. He also wrote introductions to two more photo collections, one by rock star Lenny Kravitz and one by photographer Deborah Feingold, titled Music. Now, I'm going to show you that because I actually happen to have a copy of it right here. And by the way, Feingold will be on Mr. Media in September, so come back for that. Anthony is also on the nominating committee for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and has been for the last 20 years. Oh, there's one more thing. Since 2002, DeCurtis has been a writing instructor for the University of Pennsylvania's School of Arts and Sciences. Sorry. Well, of course, what is arts ever followed by but science? That said, long introduction, worth the man. I hope I come up with a few good questions. Anthony DeCurtis, welcome to Mr. Media.
Well, thanks for having me, Bob. It's really a pleasure.
My pleasure. And you win the award for suffering through the most amount of false starts on the introduction, by the way.
It's happened many times.
I've done it. Based on your workload, I assume that you're teaching a class and conducting an interview in the background while I'm talking to you. Is that true?
Yeah, sometimes it feels like it, but, you know, it's really, I'm pretty good at compartmentalizing things, you know. The teaching is really a pleasure, I have to say. You know, it's rare, you know, that you have an occasion to just kind of carve out, in my case, a day a week. I go down to Philadelphia, you know, I meet with, you know, somewhere between 10 and 15 students who are in my seminar. And, you know, you talk about things that you really care about. You know, school was great that way. I mean, I always liked school. And so it has that feeling of just continuing that process. And I find it reinvigorating. You know, but I like to stay busy. You know, it's fun and it's exciting. I mean, I get, for the most part, to do interesting things. So I know it can look like a lot, but it, you know, I find it gratifying. And I'm happy, certainly in this current environment, to be, you know, to be sought out from time to time.
Did I manage to miss anything in my description of all of what you're working on at the moment?
Well, there is a... I did write an introduction. I mean, I really like writing these pieces for photo books, which come up independently. I mean, I don't think I'm on anybody's, you know, sort of specific list of, you know, photo writer. I have no background in photography, but I like to look at things. I mean, I always loved when I was a kid and when I was in college. I really liked art history. I mean, I felt like art critics could write in a really stylish way. And, you know, I enjoy that. And so when you get to write about photos, you know, you get to really, you want to have that kind of writerly quality to your work. And there is a book of photos of Lenny Kravitz that's going to be coming out. It's the 25th anniversary of his debut album, Let Love Rule. And Rizzoli is bringing out a photo book. So that's coming out in September as well. And I did a long piece on that. I also moderated a conversation that he had with Pharrell Williams, and so that was really a lot of fun. So that's another thing that, you know, that happened in the last few months, and that'll be making its impact in September.
So, Anthony, are you going to go my way, or are you going to go Lenny's way? That's all I want to know. Sorry.
Fair.
So, I was kind of curious, because of all the photo assignments, the photo book assignments, so to speak, if, like with the Stone, if you were one of the guys who were, like, particular about who would shoot your assignments, for example, if maybe that was...
They would never in a thousand years ask a writer who they wanted
okay.
to shoot. I mean, there was, I mean, almost a kind of a... I understand it. I mean, Rolling Stone is probably as well known for its photographs as for its writers. So, you know, the photo department, you know, liked a lot of independence, as we liked as writers. So, I mean, they would assign people that I did not necessarily think, you know, from time to time were the right person to do the kind of story. I mean, I remember doing, you know, when Sting made his record, The Soul Cages, which was about his father who had died, and it was a fairly internal record, and, you know, our conversation was as well. You know, the photographer was, you know, somebody who had, you know, he was shooting him with his shirt off, and he's, you know, there was a seeming kind of disconnect in my mind. That kind of thing would happen from time to time. You know, on the other hand, I remember doing an interview with Martin Scorsese that I think it was, I think maybe Albert Watson shot. That just took my breath away, you know, when I saw it. But no, they were not, whether I was particular or not, I paid attention to it. But, you know, it wasn't like, you know, they were coming down and consulting me on it. That was about the last thing they would ever do.
I understand. Well, I just wondered because, yeah, you're doing a lot of these introductions for these photo books. And they're, you know, I mean, Deborah Feingold's work is excellent stuff. I look forward to seeing The Journeyman. And how is Kravitz's work? I don't really know him as a photographer.
Well, it's not his photography. They're pictures of him.
Oh, okay.
I
misunderstood that.
The entire range of prominent photographers. You know, he was always somebody who I think liked that aspect of, you know, I mean, he is a photographer himself, and he does shoot, but the book is about, you know, people who have shot him over the years and his kind of evolution visually. So it's fun. I mean, I'm glad. I mean, it's something that I always wanted to do. It's like writing liner notes. That was something I always wanted to do as a kid. You know, I used to read them on records all the time, and I just thought, wow, what a great gig that would be. And, you know, so it always makes me happy when I get asked to do them. And similarly, you know, I always loved the idea of writing about visual things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can get very associative. You know, it's, I guess you can do that about music as well, but for some reason, writing about photos is really a pleasure for me. And I'm not entirely sure how it happened, but I hope it continues to because I really like it.
I've had a lot of photographers on this show who've shot for Rolling Stone and for other things, and I just find it fascinating to talk to them because you never get to hear the stories behind the photos, and you know, they tend not to be. Oh, you know, they're kind of like drummers in their own way. They're their own breed of artistic person. But I just find them fascinating to talk to. So I was curious about that.
Well, I always was struck by the degree to which, you know, there's always, you know, even to this day, you know, like, I mean, as a journalist, when you're in a room with, you know, your subject, there's a little bit of tension, you know, even if there's somebody that you've written about a lot, mm-hmm. there's a slight adversarial thing. Whereas that doesn't seem to exist with photographers for the most part. I mean, they're always palling around, and artists like them. It's very, you know, it's very lovey-dovey. But, the, you know, the work, you know, can come out to be something deeper than that.
I know working back in, and this is back in the 80s, which is, you know, for most people it's like 100 years ago, but when I would cover a concert, and we'd, you know, maybe be backstage before or after the show, there were specific photographers that I like to request because the artists, the musicians, seem to have a rapport with them. I mean, they could get away with things that I could never get away with. They could report things to me that, you know, I could see. Or if I was going to follow them back later, they could say, oh, ask about this. It happened before. So, I have a real fondness for both the craft and the craftsmen, I guess.
Yeah, one photo essay I wrote actually a few years just before Jim Marshall, I mean the great photographer, died. As a matter of fact, he and Timothy White, the photographer Timothy White, did a collaboration, and I wrote the text for their book. And I mean, that was really amazing. You know, Timothy was somebody I'd gone out on shoots with, and we'd always had a really great time. Very smart, interesting, stylish shooter, and Jim Marshall, of course, is classic. So, you know, you can have a good time with that stuff.
Well, okay. So I want to talk to you about your time at the Stone first, and we'll talk about some more recent book projects later. Take me back to the early days of Rolling Stone, and how did one score a gig like that in the 20th century? I mean, now I'm not asking for myself. I'm asking for a younger, handsomer friend, let's say.
Well, you know, for me, it happened in a very, in a way that, you know, I was too naive to know that you weren't even supposed to bother to try to do this, which is I wrote to an editor there completely out of the blue with an idea, and I got an assignment. I was in Atlanta. I was teaching at Emory University. I'd just gotten out of graduate school at Indiana. And I was out of work. My job at Emory had ended. I didn't get another one, and so I was looking around for things to do, and the B-52s were just coming back to Georgia after having, become really a national act. And so I thought, well, this would be something Rolling Stone might like. And so I just wrote a very short note with no clips to the guy who edited what was then called the performance page, a guy named Jim Henke. Mm-hmm. And one afternoon, the phone just rang, and you know, Jim said, you know, this is a really good idea. I have no idea who you are or what your writing is like, but go and review the show, and if it's good, we'll put it in the magazine. So that was how it started for me. You know, I'm not sure things, I don't know that things ever worked like that. I never discourage, when I talk to young people, as I did earlier today, and certainly when I talk to my students, I never discourage anything, any approach that, that isn't insulting or just obviously wrong. But if somebody says, gee, I really like this writer, I want to write him a letter, or, you know, that person is, you know, a really great editor, I want to just write to her. And I just always say, why don't you do that? You know, you never know what will work. And certainly now, I mean, it's an obvious free-for-all out there these days.
Yeah.
I have a hard time really even giving advice, you know, other than to try, you know, I mean, I guess my off-the-shelf advice is, you know, because it's such a kind of a Wild West scene, just if something occurs to you, just try it. But, you know, there used to be a pretty, a pretty regular formulaic way that you would try to get jobs in the past. And, you know, I went along that route. I got a few more assignments from Rolling Stone, and then that led to assignments in other places. And I sent my work out to, you know, anybody that I thought might want to see it and who could potentially help me. So, I mean, that's how I got going back, you know, back in the day.
As I guess I mentioned, Green preceded magazine by several years. Park Peterbaugh was on, and I know I'm forgetting a couple guys. And it always seems like it would be a great gig, at least for a while. You've stuck with it an enormously long time. Is it a great gig to have? Has it been a great gig?
Well, certainly working full-time at the magazine, you know, I mean, it was a job. And when people ask, you know, well, what is the thing about Rolling Stone that you know, that people don't know? And it's just, it's really how hard everybody there works. I mean, it was, you know, we were putting out in those days a very big magazine. You know, I mean, I had a lot of pages, and it came out every 2 weeks. And, you know, we worked very hard. I mean, I was traveling a lot, doing stories. On the other hand, you know, pretty much every dream, you know, Jan is famously complicated as a person. And, you know, we certainly had our tussles when I was there. But, you know, I still have a very good relationship with him. And, you know, Jan changed my life before I ever laid eyes on him. You know, I mean, Rolling Stone itself, just as a publication, was exactly what I wanted a music magazine to be. Mm-hmm. So the idea that I was having big bylines in there and writing about, you know, Paul McCartney or Mick Jagger or Keith Richards or, you know, George Harrison, Pete Townsend. I mean, every single artist who made a big impression on me as a kid and many who made an impression on me later, like, you know, R.E.M. or U2, you know, I wrote a ton about in that magazine, and it got read and it got a big response. You know, I mean, you just can't do better than that. So it was, you know, it was a real high point and remains a high point. I mean, I still am excited, you know, to be in the magazine. You know, magazines themselves these days have less impact than they used to. But, you know, to this day, when you call somebody up and you say, hey, I'm calling for doing a story for Rolling Stone, I mean, they pick up the phone, you know, and that wasn't always the case. I mean, I certainly had done enough stuff before I got there that process, you know, it made me realize, wow, like, now all I have to do is my job. You know, I don't have to be, you know, spend days, you know, trying to get a hold of somebody. It just was like, you want to talk to somebody, you get them, and then you write about it. And so that was, you know, that was incredible. Well, so I'll just conclude. I mean, I was going to say, I mean, I, you know, it was tremendously exciting.
Well, the impact of Rolling Stone, I remember being in high school and then college and then after college, and when I was writing, doing magazine pieces myself, but all through that period of time, I couldn't wait to get it in the mail, you know, and you know, before it was slick like it is now, it was the newsprint, and it was just,
yep.
I mean, you know, you never knew, and you didn't have the benefit of the internet where you knew before you got it who was going to be on the cover.
Right.
So, you know, one week, you know, it's maybe on Saturday night you saw somebody on Saturday Night Live. And then a week and a half later, oh my God, they're on the cover of Rolling Stone. And it's just like, oh, I really, you know, this is the only way I'm going to learn about this person. And I see,
right.
And you guys had such access to people and things.
Yeah. I mean, that was an amazing feeling, you know, and there was, a feeling of you could really do it the way you wanted to do it, the way you thought it should be done. You know, that Martin Scorsese interview that I was talking about, you know, it looked exactly the way it was supposed to look. You know, it was designed beautifully. The photographs are beautiful. And, you know, I got 6,000 words. You know, it was exactly the way I wanted it to be. You know, and you don't have that many experiences like that in your life. At least I haven't.
No.
You know, that where something that you care about enormously is presented in precisely the way that you would want it to be. You know, and so that, you know. It's just hard to really even put it in words. I mean, it was everything to me.
I remember doing very long stories for the newspapers in the 80s and some magazines, and you know, you could really get lost in one of those stories in a good way. You know, you could find out everything you needed to know. One of my complaints with the newspapers primarily these days, but some of the magazines as well, and I'm not putting Rolling Stone in this because, as I said, I'm not subscribing to it now, but is that the reporters are still out there gathering the same amount of information and the same knowledge and interviews. And in with the newspapers, for example, they're having to squeeze them into 5 to 10 inches of type. But the internet, to me, it's like everybody's front door is the size of Walmart. So they could be putting in, you know, these 6,000-word pieces, from the same work that they're getting from their magazine and newspaper reporters, and they don't. But you're right. I mean, that was a fantastic time. If you wanted to know everything about, I don't know, Bill Murray in 1978, 79, you could open up the Rolling Stone, and there would be this, you know, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 word story. There's photos. It's everything you possibly could want to know at that moment. And everybody talked about it. I mean, right. That was what, you know, Esquire was somewhat similar at the time. They were doing some great new journalism kind of stuff. Rolling Stone. Those were the magazines that I wanted to emulate as a guy who was coming on the scene as a writer. So,
yeah, well, it was my model, too. You know, Rolling Stone certainly was. You know, that was what I wanted to do. You know, I never, it just, you know, it seemed like a dream, you know, to be there. You know, on the other hand, you know, it was a job, and, you know, it was a hard one, you know, but it was, you know, when things would happen, you know, when, you know, like when Kurt Cobain died, for example, and we all gathered in, you know, the managing editor's office. And, you know, look, there were rivalries there, you know, it was, you know, a fair number of egos knocking around. But, you know, when you looked around that room, you just thought, oh, you know, this team can do a pretty good job on this. You know, we're gonna do this right. You know, you just saw, like, there weren't that many people that nobody had to carry anybody else's water. You know, everybody could hit it hard. And that was, you know, that was inspiring.
So I was going to ask you about some moments that kind of stood out for you while you were at the Stone, either they could be with the staff, and I think you gave a great example there of when Cobain passed, or maybe being out on assignment, either on a, you know, maybe a one-on-one interview with someone or a broader piece. Any things that, you know, kind of stand out from your experience?
Well, sure. I mean, all the ones that involved artists that made a big impression on me when I was a kid. You know, the first time I interviewed George Harrison, you know, I had to pursue him for a long time. I mean, you know, he didn't tend to do many interviews. He had some sort of gripe about Rolling Stone, as so many people seem to. You know, but I finally got him. You know, I went out to his house, you know, sat there with him for 2 hours. You know, it was incredible. I could still remember, you know, just sitting across the table from him. And I really, I mean, I was just looking at him thinking, you know, that's George Harrison. I mean, to the degree that, I mean, at one point I just said to myself, you know, his lips have stopped moving. You have to ask a question. You know, I was just, like,
that's great.
My own just reverie about where I was. But, you know, I made up a little mantra right after that, which was get excited later. You know, it was, you know, you're here, now do your job. And, you know, so that was certainly one. The first time I interviewed Keith Richards, I mean, that's one of my favorite interviews, and I should say, other than Robert Greenfield's long Keith Richards interview, which I was just a work of genius. I remember reading it when it came out. You know, whatever, in 1971. That was part of the invention of Keith Richards, I think, was that interview. But, you know, the one I did with Keith, you know, it was at the height of his feud with Mick Jagger. It was all in Rolling Stone. It got a huge amount of attention, and it was exactly what I would have wanted it to be. I mean, it was, you know, the Rolling Stones, I mean, probably to this day are my favorite band. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was, you know, incredible. You know, going to Ireland to do my first U2 cover, you know, that was fantastic. You know, I knew the REM kids from Georgia, you know, when I was living down there. I met them, and, you know, getting a chance to write about them in a big way was extremely exciting. I mean, I loved their early records. I mean, they were extraordinary. You know, I spent a good time with them down in St. Petersburg, as a matter of fact.
Really?
Time when I was down there. So, you know, I mean, all of those things, I mean, I could name 20 more, you know, I mean, they were, you know, there were so many highlights. I mean, I did a long interview with Don DeLillo, my favorite novelist in Rolling Stone, when he did his book Libra about his novel about the Kennedy assassination and Lee Harvey Oswald. I mean, that was unbelievable, you know, to get an opportunity like that.
Now,
so, you know, all of those were high points.
Answer to this question. So I'm just going to feelings about people kind of curious if you had spent time with him.
I had a very good time with him. A couple of times I interviewed him. Once for a TV show that Rolling Stone was doing, and then once for the magazine. Townsend was like a god to me when I was a kid. I loved The Who. I mean, they seemed a little bit. I mean, they were always around New York. I mean, I saw them play here 9,000 times when I was a teenager, and you know, so they seemed a little bit more accessible, like, than the Rolling Stones, who were, you know, godlike, or the Beatles, for heaven's sake. You know, so to sit and talk with Townsend was fantastic for me. You know, I had given Tommy essentially a very bad review, the Broadway show, and Townsend brought it up in our interview very, very gently, I should say. You know, I mean, success, I mean, the thing was a huge hit, but he was gracious about it and was, you know, we discussed it, and believe me, not many artists do that. Mm. You know, if you don't like something, where they, you know, either respect you or respect writers and, enough to, you know, really engage you seriously about it. As his memoir, as the saying goes in New York, I read in it. I read some of it. I read some excerpts. I didn't really have quite the will to read the whole thing, and I can certainly imagine that it would be wearying.
Interestingly, after talking to Robert Greenfield, I had started it a year or two ago and had put it down, and I hadn't gotten past, I don't think, 1959. It was so, oh, it was so ponderous and so full of just, you know, I was six, I was seven, I was just like, oh my God, I can't bear anymore. And then after I interviewed Greenfield a couple weeks ago, listening to him talk about the Stones, and I thought, you know, I want to go back, because I read Keith Richards' memoir, which was fantastic. So I pushed, and I read through the whole thing, and the middle of it was great. There was just stuff about the Who and his relationship with the other guys. But then I just came away really cold on him. He just seemed to be cold about the people around him, about Keith Moon's death, about John Entwistle's death, about, you didn't really get a sense of his relationship with Roger Daltrey as much as I would have thought. I just came away very cold, and I was very disappointed at the end, because I got very revved up in the middle, and all I could think of, I hope you'll appreciate this as a guy who's been done the book with Clive Davis and other books that you work with people, I desperately wanted to go back in time and say, Pete, hire me, I can fix this. I can make you seem like a human being again. So, I don't know. I was just curious.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I think that, I mean, I would have to read those specific sections to really get a feel. I think that, you know, Townsend had a complicated relationship to that band. I mean, you know, he was a writer. In many ways, he was a conceptualist. But, you know, he wasn't the front man. And that, you know, that doesn't seem like a big problem. But, you know, I think it was a big problem.
Yeah.
You know, it's like if you talk to Paul Simon about Bridge Over Troubled Water, you would think, wow, you know, I mean, that was a gigantic hit. But to him, I think in some sense he felt like the song became somebody else's song, essentially became Art Garfunkel's song, you know, even though he had written it. You know, and now that seems, again, like you would think, well, gee, you know, you wrote a lot of other songs, and, you know, but, you know, I think it takes a certain, you know, it takes a certain ego to be one of those people, you know, to put yourself out there that way, and that plays out in a variety of different ways, and, you know, I think. That coolness that you describe, that detachment, you know, may generate from that.
And that's why we will never run out of things in music journalism to write about, will we?
Absolutely. That's very true.
Yeah.
You know, when people say, like, you know, well, gee, you know, a lot of people have interviewed Paul McCartney, it's like, that's all right. You know, you know, a lot of people like to read those interviews, and not everybody is a rock critic who's read every single one of them. You know, I think that, you know, in the same way that, you know, our own thinking about things changes over time, so do theirs. And so, you know, I mean, I remember reading an interview with McCartney by a writer who will remain nameless, who, you know, was just, I guess, by way of wanting to not ask the questions, you know, that everybody else asks. It was asking about, like, Wings, B-sides, and things like this, and, like, I don't care.
Yeah.
If I'm talking to Paul McCartney, I'm going to ask him about John Lennon. I'm going to ask him about the Beatles. I'm going to, you know, we'll talk about other things as well. But, you know, that's why you're there, you know, and that's kind of why he's there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think, you know, this sounds terrible whenever I say it, but, you know, that idea of originality is, it's a little overrated, I think, in situations like that. What you need to do is what needs to be done, you know, and, you know, McCartney has done a lot of interviews, but if he's going to be talking about John Lennon, like, I want to hear it. I want to hear it every time he does it. Those are important figures. And, you know, you try to make it as fresh, and you try to find a way to take him to an emotional place where, you know, he's really feeling something when he talks to you. Beyond that, all you can do is go to the places that you feel it's responsible to go. And, you know, to avoid that by going into minutiae seems to me to be ridiculous.
I agree. And, you know, it's interesting. I probably, for a 20-year period, read just about every word in Rolling Stone, except maybe some of the music, the record reviews that I just wasn't interested in. And I would say I would not have thought that I would have any more interest in an interview after so many years and so many things read and so many Q&As with Paul McCartney or Billy Joel. And yet then I got sucked in on Howard Stern's show to him interviewing them. And it's like, oh, my God, there's still questions to ask. There's still things that you can find out after all these years. On top of everything that I've read in Rolling Stone or Playboy Q&A with these guys, so there's always stuff. You just have to know how to ask questions, and you have to have a curiosity and no fear. You have to be willing to ask the questions.
That's right. The curiosity is very important.
So you have made this sort of transition. I know you're still with Rolling Stone, but you made this kind of transition first with some of the books. You know, you've had some collected. Collections of your interviews, and then there's the various Rolling Stone books. But then last year you came out with this book with Clive Davis, which got a lot of attention. And I was kind of curious about the transition to doing that, because you that's where I always wanted to be you, but you've actually entered the territory of what I do, which is writing, co-authoring books with people who have a story to tell. But was it difficult for you to kind of give up kind of that full control that you would have if you were interviewing Clive for the magazine, or if you were doing a biography of Clive? It's different than if you're helping him tell his story, because he's got the ultimate authority in what goes in and what doesn't.
Absolutely. It was difficult. And, you know, but on the other hand, I mean, that was the gig. You know, I accepted it, and I tried to do it to the best of my ability, you know? I mean, it was hard, you know. I mean, let me say this. Clive was incredibly gracious. It was genuine collaboration. I mean, you know, Clive went to Harvard Law School. I mean, he knows how to write a sentence. We went over everything together very carefully. And, you know, so it was not like, you know, he just spouted off and I wrote it. I mean, we were in there working. But it finally was his book. I mean, if it came down to particular things that I believe should be in there, needed to be in there, shouldn't be in there, you know, Clive was always going to have the last word on that. Now, he always heard me out. Mm-hmm. We always discussed it. He was very open. But he finally made the decisions, you know, he wanted to make. And, you know, that was that. I just had to accept it. You know, I think that was the nature of the deal. And I think when you do those, you know, you have to have that understanding. You know, when we discussed it, you know, when we first met and talked about it, you know, I mean, it wasn't put in exactly those terms, but it was pretty clear. You know, look, it was Clive's book. I mean, Clive was paying me. It was, a publisher.
Right, right.
So I felt that my job was to get him the book that he wanted, which I think I did, you know, and it was probably 80% the book I wanted. You know, there would have been, you know, there were things I would have handled differently. But, you know, as gigs go, I mean, I doubt I'll ever be treated as well again, I have to say. I mean, Clive, you know, if you're in there and you're on the team, I mean, every time I went to meet him at his office, you know, I would get a menu in the mail from the Sony Club, you know, or what I wanted, you know, it was, you know, most of the time.
assuming that you had had dealings with him in some way beforehand.
Yeah, we had some, not a lot, but some.
Was he different to deal with, you know, where you're sitting at the table with him and you've got the same goal in mind than you're sitting across from him maybe with, you know, a different...
He was exactly the same, I have to say. You know, for the book, we did over 100 hours of interviews, and which for me was really a lot. I mean, you know, there are people at Rolling Stone who would come back from doing a story and they'd be like, oh, my God, I spent like 4 hours with every band member. Like, and I was like, really? Like... I mean, I might have spent 4 hours with them, but, you know, I sort of felt like, you know, even for a Rolling Stone interview, you know, like, which is going to be a large Q&A, I mean, I sort of felt like, you know, if you got 2 hours and then maybe an hour of follow-up, you know, if you didn't get it, you know, it wasn't going to come an hour five, you know? So pacing yourself for 100 hours of interviews with someone over the course of a year or so, I mean, that was, you know, that was hard. Yeah, it was hard for me. But it was necessary. And, you know, Clive showed up. He was there. He prepared. And so it was also easy. And, you know, he's a nice guy. You know, I mean, it was a pleasure to be around him. So, you know, I mean, there was a kind of, there's a kind of closeness that you develop with somebody when you're spending that way. There certainly were things, you know, early in the book about his family life that many members of his family did not know, you know, and, you know, I felt privileged, you know, to be in that position. So it was a different thing. I mean, you know, I'd need the right situation to do it again. I mean, the Lou Reed book I'm working on is obviously a pretty straight up biography, which has its own issues.
Well,
but,
and I wanted to ask you about that next, yeah, actually, yeah.
But it, you know, there's, you know, I felt lucky, you know, for the most part. I mean, Clive was a good subject. He worked. I mean, Clive at 82, you know, works harder certainly than I do. I mean, you know, and goes out more. I mean, Clive is out every night, you know, he loves his life and he loves, you know, he's producing Aretha Franklin now and, you know, he's producing My Fair Lady on Broadway and he's, he's got this kid named Avery that he's making a record with. I mean, he's, you know, he's busier than people like half his age.
Well, of course, when you can see, I want to put this right, but when you can see the end zone, you're more, I think with people that I've dealt with, you're a little more motivated to step up your game, even if you were, you know, even if you're already pretty busy and pretty productive. When you can see the end zone down the line, I think you work a little harder and you want to get a lot more done.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, a lot of people want to just enjoy themselves, which Clive does. I mean, I think that's finally what it comes down to. This is what he loves. And so to him to get up every day and, you know, have a full schedule and, you know, I mean, I hope I'm there when I'm his age.
Well, so let's talk about the Lou Reed Project. I know that you had interviewed Lou a number of times over the years.
Yep.
Is it, and Lou, you know, is a figure of some fascination for a lot of people.
Sure.
Is there still a lot that we don't know about Lou, or is it a matter of having it all in one place? I mean, I know you've got a contract with Little Brown to do the book. And before you answer, I have one more question. Is Mrs. Lou Reed cooperating on the book? Is she participating in this? Is she supporting it?
Laurie is not, I mean, not, I wouldn't say she's not supporting it. She's not, I mean, she's not involved in it. I mean, she's letting me do what, whatever I want. I mean, she's certainly not telling anybody not to cooperate with me or standing in the way of it. I think Laurie's trying to figure out what she wants to do. I think it's still very new to her. I mean, they're just, I mean, you know, his, you know, the results of his will just came out. I mean, there's all kinds of, I'm not a lawyer. I don't know what all these terms are, but, you know, there's all kinds of probate going on. There's all kinds of requests for things. You know, there's all kinds of things that, you know, and I think there are also major emotional issues. I mean, these people were involved for 20 years and, you know, married for a good stretch of that time. And, you know, Laurie also has her own career. So I think there's a lot on her plate. And I'm hoping that she'll come around. I mean, I wouldn't rule that out. But, you know, for right now, I'm perfectly happy to be proceeding, you know, on my own. And, you know, everybody else seems, you know, up. And, yeah, I mean, certainly there are things that we don't know. You know, I think that, you know, I mean, look, parts of the Velvet Underground history have been extremely well covered. But, you know, there are other aspects of Lou's life that, you know, haven't been looked at in a hard way. And, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, it will be a fresh read. And I'm hoping that it will be a deep read. I mean, I hope that, I mean, there are points in it, you know, I've probably written, you know, more than over 60 pages at this point. I mean, the book is not due until the end of next year, so I've got some time. And, you know, there are times that, you know, I find myself, you know, in addition to the interviews that I'm doing and, you know, the research I'm doing, I'm also putting on my critic's cap and doing a lot of interpretation. I mean, I tend to be pretty psychological in my approach to things, and, you know, I'm finding I'm liking that aspect of it. You know, so I think, you know, I think it'll break some ground, and I think it'll break some ground just in new information, but I think maybe new depth, I would like to think. So, you know, that's been my approach and what I've found so far, but, you know, there's a long way to go.
I think you inadvertently blew past a great title, by the way.
Which was?
Deep Read.
Maybe so.
I like that. Write that one down, somebody. Because I have to tell you, the thing that I'm most interested in at this point in his knowledge of him, about that man, know about Lou's story, I guess because I've been away from things, I didn't realize that they were married, and that it just sounds like a I mean, I love her work, and, you know, and Lou, of course, but, I mean, I'm just fascinated to know more about their lives together, and it would be so great if she would participate and cooperate with you at least, and give you some insight onto that. Of course, maybe she wants to do it herself, or, you know.
Well, I think, yeah, that's another possibility. You know, I don't think I honestly don't think she's decided yet, whether to cooperate with me first of all, or to do something herself, or, you know. I think she also, I think the situation, there's just a lot on her plate.
Of course. Well, you know, she's a widow now. I mean, that's a horrible thing to be dealing with, David.
And, you know, it's still fairly recent. It's not the year. But, you know, I mean, I do know a lot about their lives, you know. There are other people who know a lot about it, and they're talking, and so, you know, finding, you know, you know, were she not to cooperate, I'm not sure that there would be, I would love it if she did. I think that there will be a very three-dimensional picture of what their relationship was like.
Sure.
Regardless.
I was just flashing back. It's weird. I hadn't thought about it in a while. How much time I spent listening to, Sharky, what was it called? It's me going off topic, sorry, but I'm really interested to read the book. I look forward to that.
Sure.
Last thing I want to ask you about, we've caught you in your space, you're in your, you know, at your desk. I'm assuming it's your office.
It is my office.
Is there anything you can show us, speaking of getting behind the scenes here, is there anything you can show us that's maybe on your desk in front of you, or anything that, any things that you've collected or gathered? Obviously, you've gathered a lot of stuff behind you, but is there anything particular that's meaningful to you on your desk?
Oh, I mean, there's a million things. Let me see. God. You know, I mean, a lot of them are personal, I mean, to do with my daughter. You know, my granny is back there somewhere. There it is. Thought I'd get it.
Great. This is why I love video, because we can be, you know, snoopy.
A little dusty here.
Look at that, folks.
It's actually pretty hefty. God, it needs to be. It needs to be shined.
Can
but
you hold it up a little bit.
Oh, sure.
Oh, that's good. Oh, perfect. Wow.
There it goes. You know, it was a big thrill, I have to say. I mean, when I, you know, I had a very snooty attitude about the Grammys, right up to the time that I won one. You know, it was, you know, I remember when Bill Levinson is very, very talented. Producer, he produced the Eric Clapton box set Crossroads. You know, when he spoke to me, the first time he spoke to me about working on the liner notes for it, he goes, well, you know, we see this as a Grammy project. And I was like, look, you know.
Sure, I mean, you do.
Yeah, whatever. You know, like, I mean, I'm going to write, you know, I said, you know, you've seen my writing. I mean, you're talking to me here about what you would like me to do. You know, I can do that. That's what it will be like. Whether that's a Grammy project or not, I really have no idea. But, you know, when it got closer and I got nominated, you know, I remember my my girlfriend at the time, Kelly Scott, who was a colleague of yours at the St. Petersburg Time.
Right.
Remember, we went to Los Angeles together, and Kelly just said to me, you know, I'm getting the, because, like, once you get to Los Angeles, which is really like a company town, and all anybody's talking to about the Grammys, all I could think about was like, oh, man, like, I don't want to be here if I lose. You know, like Kelly was just said, you know, I'm just getting the feeling that you're not of the, it's a sufficient honor to be nominated thinking on this, you know. And that was true. I mean, once I got there, it was just like, Jesus, I have to win. I don't know what's going to happen here. But happily, both Bill Levinson and I did win. And it was, you know, man, I mean, I just had no idea of the reach of what the Grammys were, you know. I mean, Don Henley sent me a bottle of champagne, you know. It was, you know, my then taped, you know, voicemail was, you know, filled at work and at home, and everybody. I mean, I got letters, postcards. I mean, it was, you know, it was extraordinary. So that was, you know, I mean, that was just a major, major thrill.
That's very cool. All right, last question. I probably said that was the last question, but I got one more. You're on the nominated committee for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. What is the most misunderstood thing from the public point of view about what goes on in terms of the nominating process for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
That it's somehow like, you know, like that it's a bunch of the people who come in with, that it's some sort of conspiracy, I guess, is the main misunderstanding. I mean, I think that is another example of something where I remember talking to John Landau, who runs, you know, that committee about this one time, and John just said, you know, look, we can all go through the list of people who were in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and maybe come up with 5% who we think should not be there. Because, but for each of us, it would be a different 5%. And I think that's really true. And 95% is not a bad percentage. You know, I think that the meetings are serious. They're rigorous. Everybody who's in that room takes it very seriously. And, you know, I think for the most part, you know, we've done a pretty good job. I mean, it's the kind of thing that, you know, look, I worked at Rolling Stone. I mean, I remember, I mean, I felt like we were doing great work. I couldn't go anywhere without somebody complaining to me about the magazine. You know, I used to describe, like, when I would go to conferences and things like that. I mean, I remember seeing as a kid, like, photographs and you know, and newsreel footage of, like, you know, Nelson Rockefeller going to, you know, Venezuela and, like, having his car rocked on the way to the airport, you know. That's what it would be like, you know. You know, there would be, you know, you know, the conference, the panel would be on, you know, the future of rock and roll. The first question would be on the future of rock and roll. The second question would be about, you know, why so-and-so was on the cover of Rolling Stone list. And that would be the next hour and a half. So, I mean, I'm used to being on things that I think are very good that get criticized a lot. And that's what the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nominating committee is. I mean, I'm confident that we're doing a good job, but I'm used to people, you know, carping about it. You know, there are a lot of people who aren't in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame that I think should be, you know. I think eventually we'll get around to most of them. You know, it's like anything else. So you do the best you can.
I'm looking forward to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame having a wing for critics from the 1980s. So, I, you know, when you get to that nominated committee, just, you know, Remember this face? Folks, listen, you can find Anthony DeCurtis' latest book, The Soundtrack of My Life, which he co-authored with Clive Davis, in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. If you've seen the show before, you know if you're watching us on MrMedia.com, below the video, probably right over there, usually that's the side I put it on, is the cover of the book. You can click on it right now. It'll take you to Amazon. You can order it. They can get it to you via drone in 30 minutes, or you can have it via ebook, or they can send it to you old-fashioned, you know, Pony Express. You'll have it in 2 days. And all there'll be links to other books of Anthony's there. So please, order some books. Make it worth his while to come here. Anthony, do you have a website? I think you're on Twitter. Are you on Facebook? Where can people find you?
I'm on Facebook. I don't have a website, you know, but, you know, it isn't hard to find me.
Very good. It was a pleasure. I mentioned earlier I talked to you in 86 for something when I was at the Tampa Tribune. You were very kind then. You were very gracious with your time today. And thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media.
Well, thanks. It was so much fun. It was really a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Hi, this is Mark.
And this is Lowell. And if you're fans of Don and Mike, you may know who we are.
Our number one interns. You've met them on the show. They're the guys that ate all the junk. And they were outside with each other holding hands with a sign that said that they loved each other wearing the dunce caps.
And what you may not know is that we started out as fans back in their WAVA days.
Hi, Don and Mike. It's Mark and Lowell.
Oh, yeah. Hey, these are two guys that we once actually called them our proteges, didn't we?
And now we have our own show, so we want you to give it a shot. Just check us out at the Realm Network, realmnetwork.com, or you can go to markandlowell.com.
Resistance is futile. It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Every Tuesday and Thursday evenings right here on the Realm Network. And catch the Poor Premium Show Friday nights. Just a Minute with Joe Ardinger.
Like most people living in California, I'm deluding myself that I have the flu. But we all know it's really radiation from Fukushima. Or just the flu.
To hear the rest of this minute, to sample Joe's other minutes, and to subscribe to his newest ones, visit RealmNetwork.com. That's RELMNetwork.com. Just a Minute with Joe Ardinger, another great Realm Network production. Wednesday afternoons, right here on the Realm Network.
The preceding presentation was brought to you by the Realm Network.